भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, The Beautiful Story of the Personality of Godhead, Canto 10, the Summum Bonum, Krishna's Smiling Face, Chapter 81, The Lord Blesses Sudama Brahmana, Texts 6 and 7. Sarva Bhutat Madrik Sakshat Tasya gamanakaranam vigyaya chintayanayam Shri kamo ma bhajatpura patnya patipratayastu. Oop, it's not there. Okay, we'll just do six. This is just six. Sarva bhutatma drik sakshat tasya gamanakaranam vigyaya chintayanayam shri kamo ma bhajatpura sarva bhutatma drik sakshat Tasya gamanakaranam vigyaya chintayanayam Shri kamo ma bhajatpura Chant. Ladies, and text 7. Patnya patipratayastu sakha priya chikirshaya prapto mam asya dasyami sampado marcha durlaba. The word for word for text 6 and 7, because they're together. Sarva of all bhuta living beings atma of the hearts Drik, the witness, Sakshat, direct, Tasya, his, Sudamas, Agamana, for the coming, Karanam, the reason, Vigyaya, understanding fully, Achintayat, he thought, Na, not. I am he, Shri, of opulence. Kamaha, desirous. Ma, me, Abhijat, worshipped, Pura, in the past. And now we'll do check 7 synonyms. Patnya, of his wife. Pati, to her husband. Vrataya, chastely devoted. To, however, Sakha, my friend. Priya, the satisfaction. Chikirshaya, with the desire of securing. Praptaha, now come. Mam, to me. Asya, to him. Dasyami, I will give. Sampadaha, riches. Amartya, by the demigods. Durlabaha, unobtainable. Translation. This is Shukadev Goswami continuing to speak to Parikshit Maharaj. Being the direct witness in the hearts of all living beings, Lord Krishna fully understood why Sudama had come to see him. Thus he thought, in the past, my friend has never worshipped me out of a desire for material opulence, but now he comes to me to satisfy his chaste and devoted wife. I will give him riches that even the immortal demigods cannot obtain. Please repeat, being the direct witness in the hearts of all living beings, Lord Krishna fully understood why Sudama had come to see him. Thus he thought, in the past, my friend has never worshipped me out of a desire for material opulence, but now he comes to me to satisfy his chaste and devoted wife. I will give him riches that even the immortal demigods cannot obtain. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, and this is purport by Srila Prabhupada's faithful servants. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti comments that the Lord momentarily wondered, how has it come about, despite my omniscience, that this devotee of mine has fallen into such poverty? Then, quickly understanding the situation, he spoke to himself the words related in this verse. But someone may point out that Sudama should not have been so poverty-stricken, since appropriate enjoyment comes as a byproduct of service to God, even for a devotee who has no ulterior motives. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 9:22. Ananyas chintayanto mangi janak parayupasate teshang nityabhiyuktanam yogakshemang vahamyaham. Quote, but those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack and I preserve what they have. In response to this point, a distinction must be made between two kinds of renounced devotees. One kind is inimical to sense gratification, and the other is indifferent to it. The Supreme Lord does not force sense gratification upon the devotee who is extremely averse to worldly enjoyments. This is seen among such great renouncers as Jad Bharat. On the other hand, the Lord may give limitless wealth and power to a devotee who is neither repelled nor attracted by material things, such as Prahlad Maharaj. Up to this point in his life, Sudama Brahmana was totally averse to sense gratification. But now, out of compassion for his faithful wife, and also because he hankered to have Krishna's audience, he went to beg from the Lord. Om Ajnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkest ignorance, and my spiritual master is forcing open my eyes. With the torchlight of knowledge, I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. So, intentions, motives, these are not so easily discerned for any of us, except ultimately by Krishna, because, as it says here, sarva bhutatma driksakshat, being the direct witness in the hearts of all living beings, Lord Krishna fully understood why Sudama had come to see him. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna does not want to fight because he's seeing the whole scene, the whole scenario, the Kurukshetra war, through bodily concept. And he gave so many reasons of why he shouldn't fight. And they were all good reasons from the mundane point of view. But Krishna sang the whole Gita to reset Arjuna's vision of what was going on. And finally, in the last chapter of the Gita, because Arjuna's main reason he didn't want to fight, he thought it was really sinful. This is really bad. I mean, the Gita is such an elevated conversation that even the person in illusion is pious, and he's telling God, God, thou shalt not kill. Like it says in the Bible, right? Thou shalt not kill. That's what Arjuna is saying to Krishna in the first chapter. Papami vashrayet asman hatvaitana tatayanaha tasman narha vayanghantum dhartarastras vabandavan svajanang hikatang hatva sukanaksyama madhavam. Sin will overcome us if we slay such aggressors. Thou shalt not kill, God. Sin will overcome us. Therefore, it is not proper for us to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra and our friends. What should we gain, O Krishna, husband of the goddess of fortune? And how could we be happy by killing our own kinsmen? So that betrays his motives there. He's preaching to Krishna that we shouldn't kill, but then he's betraying the fact that he's saying this from a self-centered point of view. So Krishna has to sing the whole Gita to reorient, to reset Arjuna's vision. And finally, in the last chapter, Krishna does address that real deep-seated concern by Arjuna, 18:17. Yasya naham krito bhavo buddhir yasya nalipyate hatva pisa imalokan ahantinani badyate. One who is not motivated by false ego, whose intelligence is not entangled, though he kills men in this world, does not kill, nor is he entangled by his actions. That's like such extreme, right? This really separates the Gita from all other texts. Once Srila Prabhupada was chanting japa in front of a picture of Krishna and Arjuna, and it was where Arjuna had dropped his bow and I shall not fight. Nayotsya iti Govinda. And Prabhupada said to his servant Shrutikirti Prabhu, very difficult job. Very difficult job. Krishna said to Arjuna, kill your relatives. Right? Kill your relatives and your gurus. Bhishma, Drona. Very difficult job. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. But he did it. He killed his relatives. That is Krishna Bhajan. Kill your relatives. Sometimes Prabhupada would make extreme statements like that, because that was actually the situation. he had to kill his relatives. But after understanding that it was actually the best thing for all concerned. So motives, intentions, these are not easily discerned. These are not easily understood. In Kali Yuga especially, we're very good at, what do they say in social science or relation, what do they call it? Self-help. We're very good at making high-level negative inferences about each other's speech and actions. You know, if somebody says something I don't like, then I assume that that person said it for ill motives. I don't necessarily know the big picture. But if I did, maybe I would think twice before I thought ill. Because what I don't like in myself, I assign to others, right? What I can't face in myself, the lust, the anger, the greed, I put on other people. They call it projection, right? So, motives. What was Srila Prabhupada's motive, for example, in wanting to become a rich man? There was some prophecy by his stars and his palm that he was to be another Birla, another Tata, another Dalmya. Right? So, when he met his Guru Maharaj, he immediately wanted to join the mission, but he already was married, he had a child, and Prabhupada said in one conversation, it would have been injustice. Prabhupada was, you know, responsible. He was dutiful. So then he developed a strategy. My strategy, his strategy was that, okay, I'm supposed to become a rich man, then I'll become wealthy, and then when the family's when the children are grown and the family business is wound down, I will do the mission, right? That was his plan. So Prabhupada would tell us, so three times I built up the business, three times Krishna smashed it. It's not that Krishna didn't know Prabhupada's intentions. His intentions were not for sense gratification. His intentions were to help Lord Chaitanya's mission. But Krishna had another plan, right? Had another plan. Once there was a fire, once there was a theft, once there was some debt, and every time Krishna would smash it, Prabhupada would think of the verse. You probably know the verse. What verse did Prabhupada think of? Yasyaham. Yeah, Bhagavatam. Same canto. Yasya aham anugranami harishe taddanangshanai. When one is very sincere, but at the same time one is very entangled in this world, my first mercy upon this person is that I take everything away from him. This is why people are afraid of Krishna, right? He's Hari. He takes everything away. As Prabhupada's father told Abhai, he said, don't try to hide anything from Krishna. He has more hands than you. He can snatch it away. So Prabhupada, he was seeing his life philosophically through the eyes of the Shastras. But he kept trying. And then finally, Prabhupada saw that he wasn't going to be a rich man in the way he thought. But Prabhupada told us later, but Krishna, he made me rich in another way. He sent so many disciples, so many temples, so many books I was able to publish. I mean, externally, right? There was that Fortune 500 magazine. Was it Fortune 500? I forget. Where they said, what was it? Successful people after the age of 50. And Srila Prabhupada, I think he was number 3 on the list. And they couldn't believe how Prabhupada had just toiled in India for so many years, and then all of a sudden he came to the West and he was successful. But that was Krishna's plan. That was Krishna's way of making Prabhupada rich another way, because Prabhupada, by his intentions, by his motives, didn't waste a second, didn't waste a cent in Krishna's service. Another thing about Prabhupada's intentions was that when Prabhupada came to the West, even though now we know Prabhupada as the founder acharya of ISKCON, he did not intend to be the founder acharya of anything when he came. His intentions, if we read the Leelamrita and hear things that Prabhupada said and wrote, his intentions were to revive the Gaudiya mission. If you only have time to read one letter of Prabhupada's when he first came, read November 8th, 1965, Prabhupada's letter to his godbrother, Bhaktivilas Tirtha Maharaj. When Prabhupada came to the West, he was doing two things for the first 10 months. For one thing, he was studying his audience. He was studying Americans. There had been a lifetime of preparation, but now he had to apply that preparation in this brand new context. So he was studying Americans. Sally Agarwal reports that one morning in her house, she said, "So Swamiji was in my bathroom, and all of a sudden I saw this water coming out from underneath the bathroom door, and I was banging on the bathroom door, 'Swamiji, are you all right? Are you all right?' And she opens the door, and there's Prabhupada. He's trying to wash his clothes, Indian style, on the American bathroom floor, you know. Mush and gush and whap and bap and slam and, you know. But American bathroom floors are not sloped toward a drain because they have a tub and then they have a sink. It's not all on the same level, right? 'Oh, Swamiji, I'll have to show you the washing machine.' 'Washing machine? What's that?' And then Prabhupada said later he saw how Sally was cleaning her house. Vacuum cleaner? What's that? And then Prabhupada said, "And then when I went to your New York, sometimes I would just put a token in the meter on the bus and I would just ride around all afternoon just to see how you people were living. Something wonderful," in other words, amazing to me. He was studying his audience. But the other thing he was doing while he was living in obscurity there that first winter, that was a brutal winter, by the way. I was born and raised in the New York area. 65 going into 66. Whew. It was wicked. So Prabhupada was writing his godbrothers. He was, "Here I am. This is what Guru Maharaj wanted. He wanted us to go to the West and preach in English. Well, I'm here." So especially, there's this one letter to Bhaktivilas Tirtha Maharaj, who had been, in effect, the manager of the Gaudiya Math way back when, Kunja Bihari Prabhu. He had come from the Ramakrishna mission. He was a good fundraiser, a good manager. And so Prabhupada, in this letter, he was using the word cooperate. You know, Prabhupada's famous Mahavakya: if you love me, you'll cooperate, right? So he was saying, "So if you're ready for this cooperation, then I'm ready to serve. I have no desire to be the proprietor of any mutt or mission. But we need a building. These Americans, they're so naive, they're being fooled." Actually, it was the Ramakrishna mission again, reincarnated in America as the Vedanta Society. And Prabhupada wrote, "With their 10th class rubbish philosophy, they're fooling all these Americans who are so naive. They think they're getting some mysticism, right? But they're just getting impersonalism. So we need a..." And then they have $1 million building because thousands of people are coming. "So we need it. We need $1 million building too. We need a skyscraper too. And you, Tirtha Maharaj, by the grace of Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Prabhupada, you have those Calcutta Marwaris in the palm of your hand. You know how to fundraise, you know how to inspire them, but this is actually the mission. This is the Gaudiya mission. Priti Vita Yachayata Nagaradi Gram. And you have the contacts in Delhi to release those rupees as dollars in America. And you can be in charge. I'm your man here. I can recruit people. I can organize the whole thing. I have no desire. I have no desire to be in charge. Long before the term servant leader was coined, you know, by the corporate culture, Prabhupada was just that. That was his intention. So as we know, unfortunately, there was not much response from the other side. At first, Tirtha Maharaj wrote a kind of a short reply indicating he may be able to help. And after that, there was some avoidance. And Prabhupada was writing other godbrothers, and the disciple of one godbrother wrote back and said, I want to come, I really like to come, but I don't think my Guru Maharaj will let me come. And so Prabhupada wrote back, what is this? This is not my personal business. This is our mission. This is our mission. This is what we're all supposed to do. And then there was another letter back from the brahmachari saying, of course, if you are not authorized, then the whole business is ludicrous. And Prabhupada said, ludicrous? No, this is not ludicrous. This is what we're supposed to do. So what Lord Chaitanya showed Srila Prabhupada, that first alone, toiling alone in America, was that he wasn't going to get any help. He wasn't going to get any help. And that he was going to have to make a clean break organizationally from the debacle of the Gaudiya mission, the fragmentation. He was going to have to start something new, a fresh branch. So that was not Prabhupada's intentions, nor was it Sudama Brahmana's intentions to, you know, go to Krishna and get some big palace. You know, he was going out of compassion for his wife. They were so poor, and he was so skinny and in poor health and ragged clothes. So it was not, similarly, it wasn't Prabhupada's intentions to come to America. What to speak of, you know. Why do people go to America usually? Even from India, or maybe especially from India, I don't know. They come to see the Grand Canyon and Niagara Falls, right? And go to Disney World, generally, right? Very often they do. It says tourists. But Prabhupada said, I have not come here as a tourist. So his intention had been to become rich to do the mission. But Prabhupada told us, Krishna sent me to your country a pauper. I came, you know, what is it, 40 rupees, right? Not even an hour's spending in America, Prabhupada said. But he was rich with wisdom, rich with compassion, rich with Krishna consciousness. So that external poverty that we saw, or the first devotees saw when Swamiji landed in their midst, that worked in Prabhupada's favor. It worked in his favor that he was not an uptown Swami just pandering to the rich. It worked in Prabhupada's favor because those seekers who found Swamiji in the Bowery, in the Lower East Side, at 26 Second Avenue, in such despicable conditions, they thought, wow, this person, he's so wise and he's so learned and he's so compassionate that he's willing to come here. So it endeared Prabhupada to us that he dared to do that. Yes. So then Prabhupada had to gradually reveal what Lord Chaitanya was revealing to him. He had to gradually reveal that to us. So his intentions had been to revive the Gaudiya mission, and he did, but he had to do it in a way that he never even dreamed. He had to become the founder acharya of a fresh branch. And then he knew that he was in this context, America, that he couldn't just demand the kind of respect that his position commanded. But he was going to have to command it by his own example. So in 1965, it was obscurity. In 66, it became Swamiji, because at least he had some followers. And then in 67, after he... Prabhupada had a stroke, heart attack, in 67. He had two heart attacks on the ship, and then Krishna saved the third one for 67 when he came back to New York after opening the second center in San Francisco. And he was just getting ready to deliver a lecture on what Prabhupada called the peace formula from Gita 5:29 on the occasion of this American holiday called Memorial Day, where they honor the dead that fought in the wars to protect the American corporate interests. Unfortunately, that's the stark truth. So Prabhupada had a stroke and a heart attack and a stroke. And then he was trying to they put him on the Jersey Shore, south of New York. He wasn't getting any better. And then they sent him out to, and then Prabhupada decided, I'll go out to the West Coast, where they're going to have a Rath Yatra, because he had already opened the second center in San Francisco. And then devotees were really worried, because they knew Swamiji was very sick. And so he wasn't getting any better, even in San Francisco. Because San Francisco, even though it's sunny California, San Francisco has a very interesting climate. The Bay Area, it's like a perpetual autumn. One American writer, Mark Twain, quipped, "The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco." So the sun didn't rise over the mountains where they had Prabhupada in a little bungalow until late in the morning, and then the fog would roll in. And Prabhupada wasn't getting any better. So he's openly saying, I have to go back to India for India's heat and Ayurvedic medicine and massage. And he was so ill that actually he couldn't even go to the first Rath Yatra that they had in San Francisco. He had to stay in his bungalow. And three devotees stayed with him, Mukunda, Kirtanananda, and Hayagriva. And so Mukunda asked Swamiji a question that he didn't want to ask, but the other two kind of goaded him into it. And he said, Swamiji, after you die, or when you die, who will come and teach us? Will you send someone to be your successor? Who will come and teach us? And Prabhupada, he couldn't even answer the question. It was such an impertinent question. It was such... And finally Prabhupada said, actually it is insult. There's no one to replace the spiritual master. But first, he was very emotional. He said, my spiritual master. He was no ordinary spiritual master, if you can imagine that, an ordinary spiritual master. He saved me. And so Mukunda apologized profusely. And then later on, this is all recorded in Lilamrita and in Mukunda's book, Miracle on Second Avenue. And then in another book called Hare Krishna Explosion, Hayagriva, who was there, gave the purport. He said, Swamiji later revisited the exchange and said, actually, you should have always known. There is no one to replace the spiritual master. If someone comes and tells you one word different, you will be confused. So Prabhupada was revealing, he took that time as an opportunity to reveal that really only he could lead them, as the volume of Lilamrita is titled, only he could lead them. Yeah. Then the next, but they were still calling him Swamiji, right? Still not befitting really a title, not befitting Prabhupada, who was founding a fresh branch of the Gaudiya mission, which he never intended to do. But Lord Chaitanya is showing him now, you know, I'm uniquely empowering you because of your unique surrender to turn these international folks into Vaishnavas. So then the next year, 68, Has Govinda Dasi ever visited here? Okay, has she told the story of how Swamiji became Prabhupada? She was instrumental. She was serving as Prabhupada's personal secretary, and her husband was the personal servant. And he was dabbling in Sanskrit, and so he discovered in his readings that the term ji is a term of endearment in Sanskrit. You know, like Narada ji, Prabhupada says sometimes, Vyasa ji. And so Govinda says to Swamiji, Swamiji, Gaurasundar says he wants to call me G. Is that all right? And Prabhupada said, and Gaurasundar was there, her husband, and said, and so Swamiji said, no, better not to call her G. G is a third class form of address. So then Govinda, who was a plain-spoken Texas lady, said, well, then why are we calling you G? Why are we calling you Swami G? And so Prabhupada tried to brush it off. Oh, that's not very important. But then she pressed him. Oh, no, it's very important. We don't want to call you a third-class form of address. We want to call you the most first-class thing. Right? Because you have to understand the kind of relationship Prabhupada allowed between himself and Govinda. It was kind of like grandfather and granddaughter, you know. So she was pressing him. She was confronting him. We don't want to call you Swamiji if it's a third-class form of address. So Prabhupada sees what's happening. There's another teachable moment coming here. He's not demanding respect, but he sees now, here's an opportunity to at least give these aspiring devotees an opportunity to at least address me in a proper way. So Prabhupada, he goes from trying to brush it off to considering. Well, you can call me Gurudev or Guru Maharaj or Prabhupada. So what does Govinda say? Well, that's three. We need one. Again, pressing, right? Prabhupada's allowing her to press him. Then, if you must call me something, then call me Prabhupada. Prabhupada is nice. All right. From today, you will be known as Srila Prabhupada. So that's how it happened. So then Govinda said, so I told all the devotees. And some of them didn't like it because Prabhupada, it's kind of a tongue twister, and Swamiji, it kind of flows more easily off the tongue. But gradually we all started calling him Srila Prabhupada. Now imagine if Prabhupada had said, oh, you just call me Gurudev. Right? The change would not have been so momentous. Especially now in ISKCON, we have a multiple guru culture. We have many Gurudevs, many Guru Maharajas. But the founder Acharya's position, which he hadn't really identified yet, that was the ultimate. But at least it's gone from Swamiji to Prabhupada, a master of masters, a master at whose feet all masters sit. It wouldn't have been so momentous. And then finally, another couple of years later, the month I joined, and Jayadwada Maharaj is sitting here. Maharaj gave me my first engagement when I walked into the Boston Temple. He may not remember. I think he was proofreading Krishna book. There's a Krishna book manuscript, and he sat me down. And he said, okay, you take this copy, I'm going to check this copy. You just read as fast as you can, not stopping for sentences or paragraphs or punctuation. You just read as fast as you can. I'm going to check this. And it was all about, it was Krishna and Dwarka. It was in all his palaces. And so I didn't know what was going on. I was just reading it as fast as I could, you know, what Narada Muni was seeing in all the different palaces. Yeah. So when I joined, little did I know, there was a threat to ISKCON. Some people in India were rather jealous of Prabhupada, and they were giving some of the first devotees in India a rather compromised, minimized view of Prabhupada. And that propaganda was getting back to America, and it was affecting some of the American leaders. So one of the measures Prabhupada took to protect ISKCON was to form a GBC, to, as Prabhupada put it, to fortify ISKCON. He asked some of his still trusted leaders if they would join him and become his GBC managers, who would eventually take over the management of ISKCON. Not to replace him as the founder of Acharya, but to take over the management of the preaching mission. So that was the month I joined. Yeah. And in a legal document called Direction of Management, you see for the first time in a legal document Prabhupada's relationship to his own ISKCON Sangha, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, founder Acharya, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Prabhupada, we didn't really get it. We got it a little bit, but still there was some minimization going on. For example, before the BBT was up and running, and the next day, see, July 28th, 70, Prabhupada officially created the GBC, and then the next day, he legally created the BBT separately, because, God forbid, but if anything should happen to ISKCON, as happened to the Gaudiya month, then at least the books would be published in a separate corporate entity. But still there were things going on. So at ISKCON Press, where I joined, they were coming out with a second canto in paperback chapters. So one of the chapters was, and every time a chapter would come out, it was handed to Prabhupada, Brahmananda Swami. He was the head of the press officially, I think. Anyway, he handed Prabhupada one of the second canto chapters one day, and it said on the cover of the book, you know, who was the translator and commentator identified as A.C. Bhaktivedanta. No Swami, no Prabhupada, no founder Acharya. Not good. Prabhupada opens the book, the binding snaps, the pages go flying, because it was a little amateurishly done. So anyway, so other things happened too over the years. But the point I was trying to make, and you have to forgive me because I'm traveling with this Founder Acharya series, so I'm basically telling Prabhupada stories, but I try to connect it to the verse. So just as Sudama Brahmana's intentions were not to go to Krishna to become some, you know, rich person and get what he got from Krishna, so Prabhupada's intentions were not to become, you know, the big Swami, head of a big movement, right, to become rich. It's not the A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami movement, right? It's the Hare Krishna movement. Whereas so many gurus and swamis who have come to the West since the 1890s, that's basically what you remember about their movements, their names. Yeah. So, okay, I am going to stop. I'm going to read the verse again. Sukadeva Goswami says, being the direct witness in the hearts of all living beings, Lord Krishna fully understood why Sudama had come to see him. Thus he thought, in the past, my friend has never worshipped me out of a desire for material opulence, but now he comes to me to satisfy his chaste and devoted wife. I will give him riches that even the immortal demigods cannot obtain. Jai, any questions and comments about intentions, motives? I was trying to connect Prabhupada's life to Sudama's life there, you know, it was about intentions. Prabhupada's intentions, again, he was trying to become a rich man, but not for himself, to spread Krishna consciousness. Sudama, he was actually averse, it said in the purport. But then to help his friend and to help his wife, Krishna wanted to bless them just so they wouldn't have to suffer. It was like too austere, right? It was over the top austere. But still, Sudama, because, and he knew Sudama wouldn't be affected by it, because later on, he was able to renounce easily. He wasn't attached to all that opulence. Nor was Prabhupada attached to being able to stay all over the world in castles and manors and, you know. He was rising at midnight, wherever he was, using every second, every penny in Krishna's service, setting the example of renunciation, like Maharaj Ambarish, Yukta Vairagya, using everything for Krishna. I'm just talking, I don't see any hands. Any questions, comments? No? Okay. I guess we can stop there. Thank you for listening. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai.